This is the Create Your Own Life Show, episode 753, Mic Swap.
So entrepreneurship is somebody that has to go out and they have to find the communication lines. They have to create the product or procure the product and figure out how to sell it. Whereas like if you're in a network marketing business, they tell you how you can sell something. They tell you what you can sell. They tell you what your compensation plan is. If you are truly an entrepreneur, you would be the person developing all those things and having control over all those things. So I like to say that entrepreneurship is the best thing and the scariest thing, right? Because it's the best thing because all the freedom you can have. But at the same time, it scares the hell out of a lot of people because that level of freedom and autonomy is very scary for people.
This is the Create Your Own Life Show, where we interview people that are world-class performers, from Super Bowl champions to New York Times bestsellers to billionaires. We figure out what makes them tick and unpack it for you to do the same. I'm Jeremy Ryan Slate, and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, we help you to create your own life.
Today on the Create Your Own Life podcast, you're hearing a strange voice on this microphone as your host today. I am Tony Watley, the Side Hustle Millionaire, and Jeremy Ryan Slate is a good friend of mine. He's been on my show, I've been on his show, and today we are doing a collaborative project where we're both taking over each other's shows so that we can interview the host behind the host. Jeremy's been an incredible guest on several things. We very well connected on social media. He's doing a lot of amazing things in life. And I wanted to bring the opportunity for each of his, every one of his listeners to understand who he is, what he's about, and give you a little bit of inside scoop on who Jeremy is. Jeremy, welcome to your own show.
Hey, man. I don't even know how I got here.
I think I just kind of coerced you into this weird project and you said, you know, this sounds kind of fun, but you know, these are interesting conversations when we do a mic swap, and happy to have you participating because I would not have very few people take over my show. And anyone that's interested in this project, this is a one of two episode type thing. So go visit my podcast when you hear the end of this. It's called 365 Driven, and I hope to hear from you. So Jeremy, let's get into some details.
All right, man.
Looking at your social media, knowing you for about a little over a year and a half now, we have a lot in common. I would say that we're both intellectuals. We both like to read. We both like to lift heavy weights. And I know that you used to be competitive at powerlifting. Mm-hmm. So I've heard you or read things about you saying something like you're a nerd, but you like to lift. And that's one of the things that you and I have a lot in common. So give these people an idea about your powerlifting background.
So I was competitive in the natural powerlifting sphere. And I feel like that's important to recommend because like my numbers, if you look at the world of powerlifting, aren't as impressive, but I'm like 170 pounds now. In my mid-20s, I'm 33 now. In my mid-20s, I was at my most 212 was the most I weighed. I actually competed at the 192 class. So I used to drop weight before that. And my top that I ever did is I deadlifted 635 for a single, squatted 705 for a single, and benched 455 on a single. So it was some good stuff, man. I also pulled an 80,000 pound army tank for the Wounded Warrior Project back in the day as well.
Dude, that's some crazy numbers. I mean, we talk about the thousand club. For most humans, they can't even get into the thousand cumulative of those three lifts together. Very hard. I mean, you got to think about that. I'm in that thousand club, but you're like in the 1500 or something. I'm just doing some quick math, like 1600.
I'm not pulling those weights anymore though, man.
Yeah. But just to achieve that as a personal goal. Mm-hmm. So knowing that we have that achievement and that background, what was it that drove you to pursue that? That'd be the curious question. Mm.
So I guess there's kind of two parts to this. One was I was a wrestler. And I always liked, you know, that part of wrestling as we trained hard, we did stuff like that, but you couldn't put on a lot of muscle because if you did, you weren't going to make weight. I wrestled in the 140 class. So, and that was a tight class too. So there's always wrestle offs and everything else to have to be, you know, that weight. So that was one part of it. The other part about it is, and I've talked about this a little bit in the show before, I was picked on a ton all through school. And I thought if I looked a little bit threatening in some ways, though I'm not really, I'd get picked on a whole lot less. It worked. I got picked on a whole lot less and people thought I was cool. I guess I tricked them, right?
You know, that's actually pretty common to hear that story. I mean, here's the funny thing is I'm 5'11 now, but my mom is Japanese and she's 5 foot tall. So for most of my childhood, I was wondering if I was going to at least reach her height. Mm. So I was one of those late bloomers that grew 6 inches between sophomore and junior year. And prior to that, And I was a half Japanese kid that got picked on and had bullies in grade school. And although I was always this daredevil, adrenaline junkie type stunt kid, those are the things that really I carried into adulthood. But the thing is I also wanted to play sports, played football in high school here in Texas, and did some wrestling as well. But it's like I had to go do that to prove to myself. And then improving those abilities and the toughness to myself, I think it earns respect among your peers. You think that is?
I would definitely say that, but I'll be honest with you, man. So like my dad played professional baseball. He got up to like double A and then he had like some injuries and stuff like that. So like I was always expected to be this great athlete and I really wasn't. So I didn't really, you know, gain that respect there until, you know, the last half of high school when I became a pretty darn good wrestler in the last half of high school. So I guess like it's definitely an area where you can level it. It didn't work for me early on. And you mentioned kind of being that short guy, like I never really had the growth spurt I was supposed to be having. I'm built like a hobbit. I have size 12 feet at 5'6". Doctors always saying I was going to grow into these feet and it never really happened. So as you can imagine, I was a lot of fodder for different things that could come up for, you know, being made fun of.
I think the brain had to grow. So with the big brain, you finally caught up in the height. I mean, that's what we're really seeing, right?
I want to have a good base to stand on. I'll tell you what, though, it's helped for lifting because I have good balance for a lot of stuff.
So let's get into some of this training thing, because I know it took a lot of discipline. I want the honest answer. Did you enjoy it or did you just want the result?
So here's the thing as well. Like one of the things I picked up from wrestling was a really bad eating disorder. So I was bulimic all through high school and I would, you know, had to make weight. So I'd eat stuff. It tasted good and then I'd get rid of it. So honestly, for me, like the fuel that I put in my body for fitness was more of this thing to like handle myself better, like treat my body better and things like that. So I've always kind of looked at the right food as a tool. So, you know, my diet was always good because I knew like, hey, if I had the right ratio of carbs to proteins to fats, I knew what the result of that would be. So I guess it's not the best answer, but you know, that's really, I guess, where that part of it came from.
Yeah, you're the first one I've actually ever met that was a male that was somewhat fit that talked about bulimia, because that's something I didn't know about you. And that's a strange story in its own.
In the wrestling world, though, man, it's very, very, very common because we got to make weight. So we do some weird shit to make weight. You know what I mean? And it becomes habitual the more you do it.
But it's not really a starvation. It's really just you eat the stuff that you shouldn't and you get rid of it. Then you go eat the healthy stuff. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Okay. So you can go gorge on pizza and chicken fried steak and cheese sticks.
Here's the thing, man. You throw it up then to get rid of it. Because you don't want to get in your body because you'll gain weight. It's a pretty crazy experience. And I, you know, definitely dealt with it after the fact. But like a lot more wrestlers than you'd realize have, you know, eating disorders like that.
So when you get out of high school and you're no longer wrestling, it seems like we tend to lose our competitive event and we start looking for different things to be competitive in. And that became powerlifting for you, right?
That's honestly where I found it. Cause like I said, I was a pretty good baseball player. I was a pretty good wrestler. I mean, like I said, I wasn't a good baseball player when I was younger, but for me, I actually found my competitive edge more than I ever had it after high school, you know, because that's when I became, you know, better at working out the right way. I became a personal trainer after that standpoint, started doing competitions. I actually found my competitive edge after I was no longer, I guess, quote unquote, competing in traditional sports. Like for me, lifting and something like that, I've always had good genetics. So I gained muscle easily. So with good genetics and a good diet, like I could just, you know, burn past everybody. So because of that, like that competitive edge was lit in me like around 17 or 18 when a lot of people are actually losing it.
That's key. And I think that a lot of times I'm trying to like lure you towards the mindset side of things, the competitive mindset, because I think that's what's missing in a lot of people. When they start to evaluate their own level of success, they realize that, you know, I see other people are doing things well. And here's the thing that I think that's misleading. And you and I touched on this on the other episode from my side. People see you and I as generally helpful and concerned about other people and trying to support and lift other people. We're generally friendly in that regard, but some people don't realize we have such a competitive mindset.
Yeah.
So I want to hear the dark side of Jeremy Slayton, the mindset that you crafted in those early years that got you through powerlifting and also to be a competitive in entrepreneurship.
I don't know if it's really a dark side, man. When I'm in a gym, I'm like kind of like a different person in a lot of ways. Like I am the cockiest son of a bitch you'll ever meet, like in a gym. Outside of it, I am not, because I understand, like, you know, if I put my mind to it, I'll do it. You know what I mean? Like I know in a gym I can do that. So for me, like visualization's always been big, you know, like in terms of like before I'm going to do a big lift, I close my eyes, see myself doing it. That's always been a really, really important part of it. And, you know, I just have this crazy level of confidence to just try it and see what happens. So like I've pushed a lot of things that a lot of people said was crazy. Like I've done, you know, dips for 4 reps with 180 pounds around my waist. That's 4 plates hanging around my waist. So like, I don't know, it's kind of like this cockiness, a little bit of stupidity, and a little bit of belief that, you know, like there's no reason I can't do it. And what's the worst that can happen if I don't? So in the gym, I'm a very different person than I was outside of it. And that is definitely something I tapped into, you know, in the entrepreneurial world, because I've proven to myself a lot of what I can do. I think that's the biggest thing, is people haven't seen the products they can create, seen the end result they can create. And, you know, like I've always been a believer that, and I think you and I talked about this a little bit in our episode, that, you know, confidence comes from competence. And, you know, like the more that I saw that I could do things, you know, without really, you know, thinking twice about it, the more that, you know, knew I could attempt more.
I like this. This is an interesting observation, because you talk about being cocky in the gym. So when I hear the word cocky,
I am the cockiest son of a bitch in the gym, man. You don't want to deal with me.
Yeah. But here's the interesting, because what you did is you just basically admitted something that dudes tend to do in a gym. Okay. Most people would never mention that they do this, but here's the perspective. I go about 6 days a week, so I'm very aware of this as well. Dudes sized each other up at the gym.
Oh, absolutely.
And they look at who's lifting and they go, you know, swole bro over there's got no legs. He skips leg days like for decades.
Oh, I did not skip leg day, by the way. That was
no. Part, you know, if you've ever seen Jeremy in person, he definitely doesn't skip leg day or anything day. And that's key. But we see this a lot. And then here's the other thing. Like, you'll see taller dudes that assume they should be stronger just because they're taller. Now, this may sound like a small man complex or whatever you want to label it, a Napoleon thing. But the thing is, here's a funny thing. It's like, you'll go to these deadlift racks at the gym that I get, and you'll see these big dudes like go over there and they see you working out next to them, and you go throw an extra plate on and you do more reps, and then they try to throw another plate on to try to keep up. And you could see them looking at it out at the corner of their eye. And you could tell by their form that they've never really even done deadlifts very well or have never practiced them. They're just trying to compare themselves, and they feel that they're physically bigger, so they should be stronger. Mm-hmm. And then they're struggling over there, and you're like, dude, whatever, man. And then you throw on two more plates, and they're like, fuck, you know, and they can't even get it off the ground. But the funny thing is they'll try. They'll see you doing it knowing that you're a smaller individual, and they think that they can do that too. And then you're sitting there doing reps and they can't even get it off the ground one time. And this goes on with the bench press. It goes on. I mean, it's a very passive aggressive competition at the gym.
Here's the thing too, I'll say to that, man. Like I was saying before, like I like your posts about deadlifts, because, you know, you're almost 6 foot tall, man. It's really hard for somebody your size to deadlift like you do. I'm a midget. I can do so much that other guys can't do because I don't have to push things as far. I don't have to pull things as far. My center of balance is tighter. So actually being a smaller guy in the gym, you have a lot more ability to do a lot of things. Like if you look at a lot of the Olympia competitors, like, you know, Jay Cutler's 5'7", Ronnie Coleman, he's maybe 5'9". These bodybuilders that look huge, it's because the way that they're photographed. Like there was a German guy, Gunter Schlingkamp, and Gunter is 6'4". It's a whole lot harder for a guy like that, that's long and lean, to look massive. So when you're looking at these big bodybuilders, a lot of them are midgets, man. Like one of my training partners was 5'3", and he was an IFBB pro. So like being a smaller guy in the gym is actually a huge asset.
Yeah, I guess that does make sense just in base of physics alone, just the leverage and the pressure on your joints. When you got less range of motion, less width of arms, it's a lot harder to lift those kind of things. So that's a good point. So let's shift a little bit. So we got this competitive powerlifting mindset. We've seen that you're driven by results. You're ultra competitive. Give some analogies on why that's important with entrepreneurship and the things that you've been working on.
Well, because here's the thing, like, you know, there's four different businesses I failed at before what I'm doing now. And I think like if you talk to the average person, like they fail at one thing and they're done. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I think that's one of the biggest things I've learned. Okay, this thing didn't work. What's the next thing going to be? So it's an interesting balance, because at the same time, like, you have to be able to pivot, but also you have to be able to have the determination to get through to something once you know that's well, once you know it's going to work out. So for me, it's more about, and this is the same thing like in a gym, like I need to know the statistics about something. Like, you know, like what is the income I can make doing this? You know, what is the percentage of success for, you know, getting a product in this business? Something like that. Then I kind of know if things aren't working out, then it's me and I know that I can figure out what I need to do to change that. But if I know, like when I was in network marketing, like, you don't recruit a lot of people, you're not going to make a lot of money. That's a really hard thing to do. And it's also a really hard thing to keep those people engaged. So when I failed at that, I'm like, all right, it's not me, it's this. And so that's what you have to really understand is, you know, where do you need to change if something's going wrong? But also understand, like, is this the right opportunity for me as two, so that you can, you know, figure out if you got to drive through it or not.
That's a good one. I think that a lot of people jump into things too quickly without assessing if their core values or their purpose align with the business they're trying to start or getting pulled into. You talked about network marketing or MLMs. We talk about those kind of things. And those have a tendency to be heavily on the recruiting rather than the production. And that's the way you make money, is just recruit armies of people in your downline. And if you're not that type of person that's influential to go recruit those people and keep them engaged and get them excited about the product and teach them how to sell and all these different things, you're probably not going to do very well at it. And those are the kind of people that you and I both come across that have a different business card every 6 months with a different name on it.
Well, and dude, like, not even that, like, as well, like, hey, I know people that have been successful at that, but like, I don't know, man, like at a certain point you feel dirty because you're like, you know, I feel like I'm trying to get something over on people to get them to do that. And that's kind of no way to go through your life. And like, in order to become that type of person, it was really hard for me. So I'm just not a huge believer in that industry for that reason.
Here's another drawback for me for somebody getting into that kind of industry or any other industry that's reselling something that's not your own brand. I mean, you've got a company called Command Your Brand. Mm-hmm. It's very clear that you understand the difference between working to promote some other company versus your own. A lot of people think that they don't have a job because they're self-employed. They go work for a brand and they're supporting this brand and they think like, I'm an entrepreneur. Jeremy, you know, I both know the difference there. Give your definition of what entrepreneurship is versus self-employment.
So entrepreneurship is somebody that has to go out and they have to find the communication lines. They have to create the product or procure the product and figure out how to sell it. Whereas like if you're in a network marketing business, they tell you how you can sell something. They tell you what you can sell. They tell you what your compensation plan is. If you are truly an entrepreneur, you would be the person developing all those things and having control over all those things. So I like to say that entrepreneurship is the best thing and the scariest thing, right? Because it's the best thing because all the freedom you can have. But at the same time, it scares the hell out of a lot of people because that level of freedom and autonomy is very scary for people. I guess, I don't know if entrepreneur is even the right word. I guess you're more like a statutory worker. In the insurance field, they have a term for which is a statutory worker, which is somebody that works for a company, can't make any choices about it, but they're totally responsible for their own business. So I guess it's a similar thing in network marketing.
Yeah, I think the main thing that I look at from a business perspective is you take on more risk. You actually take on all the risk as a actual entrepreneur because you own the brand, you own all the processes, the systems, the hiring infrastructure, the scalability, the financial risks, all on your risk. If you go work for some other brand, they take all those risks away from you. You're just basically a soldier within that brand. So there's a big difference. So don't fool yourself that thinking that you're an entrepreneur until you start to learn how to take those risks. And that's why you listen to shows like ours and read hundreds of books and you hire coaches to learn these kind of things because we don't all start out with that knowledge. Mm-hmm. That's a great description between the two. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, man.
Now, going back into some of your background for the listeners, Oxford education, Seton Hall education, you've got a degree in philosophy and literature and you became a writer for a moment of your life and then you started to get into the new media. But where was the motivation behind the literature background?
Really bad advice and not really thinking for myself in a lot of ways. I don't know, because like I love my parents dearly, but like what parent in their right mind would say, hey, it's a good idea to go keep getting degrees without the idea of what you're going to do with this? That was kind of the thought, man. Like I just kept going to school because it was like what I knew how to do and I was good at it. So I loved learning. I loved, you know, a lot of things around that. And here's a great example of that. I got to my senior year of college and my advisor says, hey, I need to talk to you. Let's sit down. So I sit down and he goes, you know, if you take one more class next semester, you could have a double major. And if you had thought about this earlier in the year, you could have a triple major because you needed two more classes for another major. I'm like, so like, I wasn't really doing it for a reason of getting a result, right? It was just like, hey, I enjoy this information. This is interesting information. Let me learn more about it. So my college career, man, like I don't need it because I don't use it. And it's not to say that we don't need college in some areas. Like if you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or something like that, you need it. But for like what I do now, you don't. A lot of what I did was self-education. I will say, I know you and I were talking about this earlier, I have three teachers that really changed my life. And one of those was a graduate school teacher that I'm still friends with to this day. I mean, I learned the most from him that I ever learned. But like, I don't know, like I didn't have to go to those classes to learn from him in that way because most of the learning I got from him was outside of the classroom. So to make a long story short here, I was just kind of pursuing what interested me and not really a purpose for it. And I think that's where a lot of students and a lot of kids going into school go wrong is like, all right, I'm going to major in this. And you're making a decision at 17 or 18 years old, not realizing at 23, 24, 25, you're going to have to figure out how to make money from this because it's not really an aspect we're thought of. I think the biggest thing missing more trade schools. I think more apprenticeships are missing, like, you know, where you work under somebody from a period of time and discern if this is right. And if it is, and you need education, then you go get it. So I think we need to change what kids are doing at 18 or 19 years old, because then you end up like I did at 24 with a whole bunch of student loans coming out, realizing, what am I going to do with these degrees other than put them on my wall?
We had the same question on that one, because when you talked about your professors telling you about, hey, if you take this one more course, you can get a degree. I'm going to say that the infomercial voice, hey, Jeremy, if you buy this one more course, you'll have an added degree to your curriculum and you'll hang an extra thing hanging on the wall just for a sum total of $4,000. Sign here. It's an upsell. They're trying to keep this business model going. Mm-hmm. I got proposed the exact same thing. I'm an engineering degree. If I would have taken one more class in something BS like math theory, I could have had a double major in mathematics because, yeah, we take all the maths. And I was like, nah, I don't need that, because that's not what I want to do. And I don't have the money, because that means I had to go work an extra 6 months to be able to pay for these courses. So I said no, but I immediately knew right then it was an upsell. It was like a business model they're trying to perpetuate.
Is it only $97, man?
Probably, because I went to a state, you know, University of Houston. It wasn't that expensive. So it was probably $97 at that time. I'm pretty old, right?
I have to buy their $47 book first, then I can get their $97 course.
Well, it's probably $97 a week or $97 a month to follow that. You signed it before you read the fine print. You know, that's how they do it, you know. But that is interesting. I think there's a lot of people out there that have followed a degree plan based on bad suggestions or bad advice. And I get it, man. When we're 17, 18 years old, we really don't know what we want to do in our lives. We don't have a purpose. Even in your 20s, maybe even part of your 30s, you don't really know what you're doing. You have a different goal or perspective through each decade of your life. So maybe that's a good highlight.
Here's what's insane to me around that, right?
Yeah.
Like at 17, 18 years old, you can get a loan for school at, you know, sometimes $100,000 or more. But if you went and said, I want a business loan, they deny you.
Dude,
but with no collateral, they're going to give you a student loan, which, by the way, are the only loans that are compounded interest every single day. So your student loan that you're buying at 18, the interest is deferred till you graduate, but you're compounding that percentage of interest every single day. It's criminal, man.
Yeah, it's terrible. And college has gotten so expensive in a lot of these different places that it compounds that even worse. Now you got an expensive loan and an expensive school. And here's the bad thing is if you don't finish school, that loan is just going to sit there and you don't even have a degree to show for it. Mm-hmm. So very common. So if you're listening to this, don't take advice from people who are not doing what you want to do. And if that includes your parents, yes, that's the hard truth, because sometimes parents will mislead you. I'll tell you, I get a lot of coaching clients that come in that are in their mid-30s and they're depressed and they're unhappy and they have a lot of stress in their lives and they don't know why. They're highly paid because they've got a profession. Maybe they're a lawyer, they're a doctor, they're an engineer, and they just don't know what's wrong with them. I'll tell you, 9 times out of 10, it's because they're working in a career path that is not aligned with their core values or their interests. Mm-hmm. So they have the sunk cost fallacy, much like I did with my engineering degree, that they didn't want to leave because they're highly paid and they think that they've invested all this time in their education. So they get stuck in that kind of career path. But what they really want to go do is something completely different, which would make them happy and feel more fulfilled. But you got to be willing to be brave to go do that. And very few people are willing to evolve.
Well, and here's the thing about that too, man. There's like a myth of education as well. Like both of my parents didn't go to college. They were just high school graduates. And I come from, you know, small town America where people don't really go to college. So like the thing was get an education because that's going to be the step up, right? Like that's going to be the step up. So like you were sold this false idea that you have to get an education to get a step up when you really don't, man. Our media and our books and our movies, they don't really talk about the people that, you know, didn't go to school. They don't talk about the Purdue's of the world and people like that that are self-made. And I think there needs to be, you know, just like a lot of what you promote on 365 Driven, there needs to be people that have gotten to the careers they're in because they did it, not because of their education and stuff like that, because it's a myth. This episode is sponsored by Command Your Brand, your source to build your brand, get more business, grow, and create the attention that your brand really deserves by becoming a guest on some of the top, most top-rated podcasts in the world, just like this one. If you want to get out there, get more attention, and grow your brand, then Command Your Brand will help you define exactly who you need to be in front of, help you tell a better story, locate and book you on the right podcasts, and also
help you create content that's going to create even more ROI for you years down the road. So if you want to find out more, head over to commandyourbrand.com, drop a line, and figure out how you can start to take command of your brand.
Absolutely. I think that's funny as this sounds is even with an engineering degree, there was probably a period of 5 to 10 years after graduating, actually working in the oil and gas industry, where I actually started to discover a lot of the reasons I learned the things that I learned in school. So it's like you come out of school with a degree and you think that maybe you're smart, but until you start applying things and actually going, oh, like these light, you have these light bulb moments. Yep. And you're like, that's why I learned that. Because in school, we basically were taught to memorize stuff for no reason behind it and just kind of regurgitate the answers to get the test. And and you go, well, I don't even know what this is for. And they don't teach you very well in the application side of things until you actually get in the workforce. But then you realize like, well, wait a minute. I could have just been doing this job and actually learned the same shit on the job that as I went and not even need that degree. Now it's like the light bulb moment's like, ah. This is just a buy-in into the big scam, and it's a great topic. I love that. So you were a writer. You moved into what we call new media today. And what was it that attracted you into podcasting in general?
Failing at everything. So I mentioned that professor I had in graduate school, coolest dude ever. We just, you know, sit around and talk about history and stuff like that. And you know who Neil Patrick Harris is?
Yeah.
Okay.
Doogie Howser.
He looked and sounded like Neil Patrick Harris. So the dude was a laugh a minute. It was hilarious. And I walk into his office the one day, there's this show playing and it sounds like it's a morning show. I'm like, what the hell is this? And then they're reading this, like people would donate to the show and they would call each other out. They would call each other out in the show. They would call out other people that didn't donate as douchebags. So I'm like, what the hell is going on here? So I walk in the office and be like, douchebag. And I'd be like, what is happening here? He's like, oh, this is a podcast. I'm like, what is this? So I still listen to that podcast to this day. It's called The No Agenda Show. They actually grab news stories from all over the place, like C-SPAN and stuff like that. And they try and just decide, like, what does this actually mean if you take the politics out of it? So it's a very funny show. It's a little bit vulgar in some ways, but that was my first introduction to podcasting. So I started listening to that podcast in 2007. And that's when a lot of early podcasts were still like audiobooks and stuff like that. So I checked out that, some other shows. And, you know, once I failed at, I had always been listening to podcasts in the background, but once I had failed at, you know, network marketing, insurance sales, selling products on Amazon, web design, doing all this different stuff. I'm like, all right, well, I guess I'm not very good at all this other stuff. How hard would it be to start a podcast? Apparently pretty darn hard because the first one was horrible and nobody listened to it. So I was like, all right, what's missing here? And this goes back to the education aspect.
Wait, I want to stop you. What was the name of the first show?
Rock Your Life. I was a life coach, man. I was going to show you how to be
I
the
love
best
this.
Pony you
I love
be.
It. I love it. Rock
and
your life.
I didn't
life.
Know what trademarks were either. So I got a cease and desist from the person that actually had the name. It was a music show and they had a trademark. So I changed the spelling and it became Rock Your Life, the letter U and R. So it just looked like I couldn't spell. So I'm somebody that can't spell with a podcast without microphones. It's just me talking my MacBook. So I was like, was kind of like
that was the wrestling coach voice.
Yeah. And it's like I'm telling people about achieving their dreams, doing all this stuff that I hadn't done with my life. Like, dude, if I had to listen to this now, I would cry. It was that bad. And it got 99 downloads. We didn't even hit 100 in 3 months. And I put out like 25 episodes. So you can imagine how bad it was.
You have to go find one of those episodes. I know that you got it saved on some drive somewhere.
Oh, I have it on an external hard drive. Trust me.
Dude, you got it. Hey, listeners, hashtag him on this one and tell him like, hey, we want to hear one of those first episodes. Just as a fun, it could be your Friday show thing. Just go, hey, you know what? I want to show you how bad things could have been. This is one of my very first podcast episodes. And dude, that's awesome. I love this. See, we're getting to the...
And you know what's funny is like people that know me well, no, I'm not like the airy, light, personal development yoga guy. Like, I'm kind of like, I don't know. I'm New York. Like, hey, get out of my way. What's wrong with you? So like, it was just kind of weird because it like didn't fit with who I am at all. It was just like this thing that like, oh, I'm going to go make magical internet money. And I didn't make the magical internet money and be famous. So that was the first show, man. And from there, like that didn't really do well. So I quit. I then applied to this program with Rotary International, where you basically like, you know, go to another country and research the careers and stuff there. So they paid for me to go live in Peru for a couple months, which is kind of cool. So I lived in Peru on, you know, Rotary's dime. Thank you, Rotary. And it kind of taught me a lot more about the world. Cause like I said, I'm from a small community and I'm like, all right, so this podcast thing. I really am interested in it. Let me consider doing it again, but let me like do it more as a professional. So I went out and I sought the right kind of pointed education. I got a course, but I was really cheap at that point in time. So I found a promo code where I got it 97% off so I could still afford it. And that first course got me started, man. And that's where Create Your Own Life came from.
So right away, you knew the premise of the new show and you were going to go pursue that. Has it evolved any from the beginning to now? Or what was your initial focus on?
So it was like creating life on your own terms, which that's a really, really, really broad spectrum. And what I found is I would get a lot of guest pitches that weren't like even close to where I was going. Like, hi, I'm Joe the Plumber and I can create my own life. And it's like, sure, you have Joe and I bet you've done a great job, but it's not really who I want to talk to. And as it's kind of gone on, it's developed, right? It's become world-class individuals. But then even past that, I looked at it, I'm like, all right, well, there's a lot of people that want to talk to world-class individuals. And I was talking to a friend of mine about this. I'm like, who are my people? My people are rebels. They're people that don't do things the way other people ask them to do. They look at a path and they say, yeah, I'm going to go that way. They want to do things their own way. And they want to do it, you know, in a way that society doesn't tell them to, because I'm not a rule follower. I'm not somebody that, you know, like, you make a law, I'm going to agree with it and go do it. Like, it's, I want to do what logically makes sense and what's going to get a result and what's going to create the biggest impact. And so that's really driven like who we feature on this show. And that's why some people, maybe they've done a lot, they've done a lot of cool stuff, but they're not a fit for, you know, who we're going to feature on Create Your Own Life.
I like that distinction, because there are a lot of people out there who are successful that are just pure rule followers, and they actually become the very vocal rule shamers that we see.
Boring, man.
I mean, it's so boring. When you have the word create in your title and they haven't really created much in their lives except follow rules, it's kind of like, well, why would we want these people on a show? And I get that, man. It's,
well, that's a good topic. Capital and stuff like that annoys me. Like, all right, I'm going to go get somebody else to give me a whole bunch of money. And if it doesn't work out, it's not my problem. Like, in pure entrepreneurship, like if you figure out a product, you figure out how to sell that product and you got to deliver it fast enough that you don't die. That's pretty high stakes stuff, man. That's way more impressive to me than somebody that's like, all right, so in school, we developed this computer program and I found all these people to give me money. Then I paid myself a salary from that. And you know what I mean? Like, I didn't make any personal money my first year in business. All that went to all the people that I hired. So it's like, I just think it's a different kind of mindset, a different kind of beingness. You know what I mean?
Yeah, so that's what we call the Silicon Valley business model, where they just basically do the pump and dump. They do a lot of branding, and what they do, I actually learned the strategies from some really high level names that most people would recognize. But the thing is that they'll bring in influential names as one of their backers, and they'll leverage that person's credibility or that person's fame or influence. And then when other people see that so-and-so is invested in it, they start to dump their millions into the same project.
Yep.
And then, and only then is when it finally goes to the market and it maybe even makes a profit sometimes. Mm-hmm. And the thing is they don't have any actual proven business models before they get that investment amount. So they're booked as, hey, we got a multi-million dollar business and we got this entrepreneur who's worth $50 million because of all the venture capital money.
Well, like, you look at something like Amazon, right? Like, they make a lot of money now, right? But their first 14 years, the company wasn't profitable, but Jeff Bezos still made money. Like, that's insane to me. Like, how does that make any sense? Like, if you or I were in business for 14 years without making money, we wouldn't last the first four. You know what I mean?
And I don't even think Uber is making any money yet, if I'm not mistaken.
No, they're not profitable.
And it's a household name.
And people, everybody wants to be the Uber of something, but they don't make any money.
Well, I want to make money, man.
I want to be the Uber of making money.
Is that a false positive?
It is a false positive. It's like a coronavirus test. Anyway,
it's good stuff. So now you've been podcasting 4.5 years. What have you discovered about podcasting in general that maybe you didn't know in that amount of time?
It's one of them's a simple one, man, about like how much audio quality matters. Like, I'm surprised like how much listenability of a show really, really matters. Number two is sometimes that guests that I'm really interested in, I think my audience would be really interested in, and I get done with the interview and I'm like, oh my God, that was great. I find out maybe it wasn't what the audience is looking for. So I think we also find that, you know, not everybody believes and thinks the way we think, you know, when we put out a really great piece of content, and sometimes that sends you back to the drawing board. So you have to understand, like, the reason you're doing the show, you know, it isn't just about you, man. It's about the people listening to you. Because if nobody was listening to you, number one, people that agree to do the show because of listeners, like because of the number of people listening to you, wouldn't do it. Number two, like, what's really the damn point? You know what I mean? Like, why would I be creating this content? Because I don't listen to it after I'm done, because I don't like to hear the sound of my own voice. So, like, you know what I mean? It's about the people you're doing it for.
I think that's some good tangible takeaways we can give to the audience, because there's a lot of people out there listening that are curious about how they get to be a guest on a show like yours or mine. Let's give them some tips.
So one of the things that you really need to do is, like, you know, get down your message, because I feel like, and you've probably seen this too, you get a lot of people that send you a pitch and there's just not very clear messaging. And the pitch is also all about them. It's not about, like, you and what they could do for your audience and how they can help them. Because I got a pitch the other day. It was really weird. And it was about all about a guest that I previously had in the show. So reading it, I'm like, this is a pitch for the previous guest. So I read it and I respond to the guy, hey, you know, I actually had him on 6 months ago. We had a great conversation, but I'm really not looking to do repeat guests right now. And he goes, yeah, I know. This was a pitch for me. I'm like, you weren't mentioned in it. Where are you? So it's like, you need to make sure that, like, number one, you're being clear with why you're doing this and what you're doing. And it has to be about the show. Like, it's really important that it's about the show that you're going to, and really make it matter. Don't make it copy paste if you can get away with it.
That is the key. Okay. So if you're listening to this and you pitch because you've got a new book coming out, or you pitch because you want to generate leads for your business, or you pitch because you want to pat yourself on the back and tell everybody how great you are, you're missing the point, because there's thousands of people listening to our show and you're essentially standing on a stage in front of thousands of people and you're trying to give them value. And when you start to be more externally focused on giving them value and less internally focused thinking about yourself, that's when you start to actually attract audience and become influential and get the people that you need in your own personal audience. But so many people do this wrong. And here's another misconception that I think a lot of people who pitch don't realize, is that podcast hosts, especially if you've been in the game at least a year, let's say that your show is well established, you're a year plus in, we have hundreds of people applying to be on that show.
That barrier to entry is very high.
Dude, it's so many. And you think about this, so if we're only doing 52 episodes a year, that's 52 conversations that we can have per year. Mm-hmm. Dude, I get 52 propositions per week. Mm-hmm. So there's no shortage of guests. So you have to do things to make yourself stand out among that sea of people who are interested in getting on your microphone.
Well, and it's funny too, you mentioned book launch, and I started laughing when you said that, because actually the best worst pitch I ever received was, I had somebody send me, you know, a pitch that was basically like, I want your audience to buy my book. I'm like, I'm glad we're definitely on the same page here. And it was just the weirdest flow I'd ever received. I'm like, you want my audience to buy your book. Okay, what are you going to do for them? And I think that's really, really important when you're pitching that way, man. Like, what is in it for the people that are listening to this? I get a really good laugh out of it when I get something like that. Or here's the other one too. Like, make sure you're addressing it to the right person. Like, hey, Jeremy, I would love to be on the Solopreneur Hour. So I responded, yeah, man, me too. And they were like, I didn't get a response to my response, but like, you need to personalize the process.
Honestly, I don't even respond to any of those posts unless I want the guests. You just get too many.
Yeah, but like I told you, I'm New York antagonistic. So like, you know, I'm going to kind of have fun with that when I get something like that.
Well, for me, they call me Tom sometimes. Say, hey, Tom. It's like, how do you get Tom from Tony? I mean,
Tommy Watley.
It's not even the same like spelling. I mean, come on, guys, get on your game the proper way. And here's the other thing that most people don't realize. A lot of us podcasters are friends, and we'll share notes sometimes of these terrible pitches. Like, I'll send one to a friend of mine, like, look at this terrible pitch. And he's like, yeah, I got the same one. And all they literally did was just change the name at the top of it. And it's like, it's like, this person's out there flooding hundreds of podcast guests with this terrible pitch, and we're going to remember that person. And it's like, dude, some of these people do things so detrimental to their own reputation, they don't even realize it.
Well, you know, it's funny, man, is eventually at some point in the future, I don't really have enough time to do it, but I want to at some point in time have a podcast where I read two things. Number one, the bad pitches I receive. And number two, my spam box. My spam box, man, is gold. I got an email from Anne Frank the other day. She's alive. She's living in Africa. She knows the king of Nigeria and can give me a whole bunch of money. She just needs my social security number.
I remember that post. You put it out on social media. I laughed. I said something about Anne Frank must be in digital marketing now or something. It was funny. But yeah, that actually would be a pretty funny show, to be honest. Like, it could be a satirical, like, bad pitch, because let's be honest, there's a lot of shows out there teaching people how to do things right.
Yeah.
And you hear the same information over and over because there's very few ways to do things right. But I don't think there is a show of doing things wrong.
Here's a funny one too. I had Ted Nugent on the show not too long ago. My listeners will remember this. And I actually came on the show after, and I read all the weird comments I got on social media to the interview. And like, somebody was like, go eat a bag of dicks, Ted. And it's like, what does this have to do with anything? So like, somebody's got to create that, man. I don't know if it's me. I don't know if it's you. Somebody's got to create that show where they.
It's kind of like the mean tweets. You know, that this could be a collaboration project for us. This would be kind of fun. Like, okay, let's read the bad pitches and bad tweets and see the bad social media examples that we want to report on. We could have like the terrible news media show. So just that project rattling around in my head is making me want to laugh. I'm trying to keep a straight face and get through this interview, but the good stuff, man. So another tip I would say that most people kind of fail at when they try to be a guest is, here's the other thing, is they over communicate and they're overly persistent. Okay. Let me give an example of this. Just this morning, I go into my inbox and I see someone that's pitching themselves to be on my show. It's like, okay, that's cool. We'll get those all the time. And then I go to Instagram and the person is hitting me there with the exact same copy and paste message, trying to get on my show. And then I go to LinkedIn and there's the same person again, trying to get me, you know, to pay attention to him. So guys, if you're doing that, that's terrible advice. Like, go find the one thing that most people are active on. And it's pretty easy. If you're trying to get on somebody's show, you can go browse Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn, and you can pretty much tell which one they prefer to be, you know, communicating or they're most active on. Just pick one. Don't do this three-way effort thing. It's like,
and don't download all their emails from LinkedIn either and put them in a CRM. They're going to hate you. I'm like, how did I get on this list? How did I get here?
It's like creeper-tastic. It's like, it's almost like they're a stalker. So we're giving good ways not to get on shows, man. So don't do that. Don't come in with something to say like, I want to promote this. You're never going to get on a show with that unless it's a show specifically for promoting what you're promoting. But yeah, just change your messaging. Another thing that you and I talked about before we fired up this episode, people who big league and don't share what they're participating in.
Yeah.
Give an example.
It blows my mind, man. Like, it doesn't make any sense. We have had the client here and there that doesn't do that either. And you and I were talking about that. And it doesn't make any sense. First of all, hire a firm and then not share it. Like, why would you spend money and then not share it? But then number two, like, it's social proof. Like, you need to be showing people like that you're doing stuff. And I think that's really, really important as well. And a two-way flow, man. It helps show, it helps you. So like, why wouldn't you do it?
It's good stuff. So now I'm going to give some advice to people who are maybe thinking about starting a podcast, or maybe they're in their first 50 episodes or less. You and I both know most people quit, yeah, what they call pod bait.
Yeah.
Is it 20 now? It used to be like 7. 20. So
yeah.
Hey, we doubled it. You know,
doubled it, man. We're getting there. We're almost three times it.
But here's the thing is that if you don't stick with it at least 12 months, I think you're not even, you shouldn't even start. That's what I tell people. You know, I'm coaching people that come to me advice on like, how do I get a, you know, I want to do a podcast. Like, hey, you ready to do a one episode per week minimum for 12 months? And some of them are like, no, I don't think I have time. That's like, then don't even start.
Yep.
You don't even start. Here's the problem is we're all competing for the same attention. Okay. Everybody out there has got hours of listeners as a commodity. We all have the same target market. And we realize that if we're going to do that, we have to be as competitive or create the same amount of value as the people are out there. And we realize that our audience starts small. But the thing is if you don't show that consistency over time and deliver the value, then you're never going to get an audience. So why even start?
Mm-hmm.
So people don't realize that kind of stuff. They think that they're going to fire up a microphone. And you, funny thing is you and I are members of these podcast groups on Facebook. And it's funny because people will come in there and go, hey guys, I've got my first 5 episodes uploaded. What was your download count in your first 5 episodes? And you're like, oh my God, just shoot me in the face.
I was at an event not too long ago and there was a woman up on stage. It was a small local event, but she's up on stage like talking about like everything you need to be doing in podcasting. And it was like, wow, this is a very aggressive talk. So I'm like, let me go check her out while I'm sitting here. I'm really bored listening to her. So I'm like looking and like she has no reviews of her podcast. She's put out an episode every now and then. She doesn't do anything on social media. And I'm like, where do these people get these ideas? That's also the same type too, is I feel like you have people giving bad advice when they haven't really like achieved something. You know what I mean? Anyway.
That goes across all types of knowledge bases though,
and they're
right?
So aggressive about it too. They're like, this is the only exact way to do it.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Even in the marketing things, here's another thing that we see. Like even if you're going to go out there and build your personal brand, it can't always be about you. There's so many people just doing that same thing. Yeah. They're just talking about themselves, posting a picture of themselves, talking about themselves like over and over and
over.
And they
wonder why. Here's me in a floppy hat, millennial hat. Here's me doing this.
Nobody cares. Like they're not going to follow you. They're not going to listen to what you're saying because you're not directing your message to them. It's always about them. That's a great key takeaway for this episode, Jeremy. And I've really got to enjoy getting to know you in the background.
This was a unique conversation, man. You pulled a lot of stuff out of me I don't talk about.
We definitely need to hear one of the early Jeremy Slate podcast episodes. No, you know, if how about this? If you do it, I'll do it, because I did 6 episodes. My very first podcast as a co-host was 2008. So I go way back. I did 6 episodes in an automotive podcast that was based around my community that I built. I think it was called Planet LSX Podcast or something. And there was 3 of us. It was me, my business partner, and actually a guy that's still podcasting. He's got a very successful show now. But he had us both on as co-hosts for this series. Dude, I was so nervous and I didn't like the way I sounded and just I have more of a country Texas accent back then. And it was really uncomfortable. So I started making excuses that I was just too busy and that I had bowed out of that project because, you know, you listen, you talked about discovering podcast 2007, 2008. Dude, nobody knew what a podcast was back then. It was kind of nerdy when you told someone that you had a podcast and you probably had 10 downloads, let's be honest. Like it was like really like nobody listening back then.
Yeah, except me with trying to get through 3 months and somehow not even breaking 100. It's like, come on, bro. Come on. Am I that?
So I'm going to go try to find one of my old episodes. I'll talk to the guy.
I have them all and I don't know why I've actually saved them, but they are embarrassing, man.
Dude, just pick a good one. Just go, hey, you know what? This is one of my first episodes. Because here's the importance behind that. People see what you're doing today. People see what I'm doing today and they think it's very easy. Mm-hmm. And they go, you know, I could do that. Or maybe they got the people that realize they don't have the skills or the background or the training to be able to speak clearly and do these things. Mm-hmm. And they have a lot of self-doubt because they see you and I do it. And they go, these guys have always had that gift. It makes it look really easy. Like I could never do that. Well, when they hear these really shitty examples of things that we were like when we were beginning, what that does is it creates a belief within them that anything is possible. As funny as that sounds, like we want to lead by example, right? Like, dude,
it's bad though. It's like, I'm here in the wind tunnel and Tony, you could have anything you want to have. You just got to have a burning desire, man.
That's good stuff. Good stuff. So I look forward to hearing that episode, Jeremy. Tag me in that one too. Good stuff, man. Well, guys, thank you for listening in. This has been one of those experimental episodes that's always fun. We call it a mic swap. You guys go listen to my show, 365 Driven, and you'll hear Jeremy interviewing me on my show. He has some really in-depth questions. That's why I had him as a host. He's a great friend, and I love getting to see him in person when we go to these different events. But you guys are a great audience, and I love this show myself. I'm an avid listener, and you know, thank you for listening to this experimental mic swap. Tony Whatley out.
Absolutely, guys. So go check out the 365 Driven podcast so you can find out more about Tony, who is way more interesting than I am. And we learned a lot of amazing stuff in this episode. I do appreciate him coming on here and kind of rattling my cage a little bit and trying to get me to talk about some stuff I don't talk about. So, Tony, thanks for being on the show today, man.
Rock on, brother.